Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ahí va a llegar el gol del Arsenal. Ozil marca. Mesut Ozil, corner, llegó el gol de Olivier Giroud, marca el Arsenal, marca Olivier Giroud, gol de los Gunners.
This is Arscast Extra.
Hello there and welcome to another Arscast Extra, as always, with James from Gunner Blog. A goodly Halloween to you.
Spooky morning.
Yes, indeed, a spooky morning.
Yeah. Have there been any Halloween festivities around your way that you've partaken in?
No, not yet. Not yet. I mean, not that I will either. I'm a bit old for all that, you know. But sure. I think the kids will call to the door later of the neighbourhood begging for sweets and chocolate and, you know, we'll just set the dog on them.
Yeah, of course. Tricks only at your house.
Yes, yes. You know, unless your treat is being slobbered on by a gigantic German shepherd, you know, which is fine. Lots of people like that.
That's fine. Mm. Exactly, whatever your bag happens to be.
Yeah.
I was out in London this weekend, and it is obviously distressing. It is like a kind of zombie apocalypse, the Halloween weekend.
Yesterday we were walking into town, and a guy walked out of a bar. This was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I looked at him and went, holy shit! What the fuck happened to that guy? Because he had like this really quite cool makeup on. So it looked like his face had been like sliced open. And then I was like, oh yeah, phew. It's like a fancy dress thing. But he was sort of half zombie-ish, half like destroyed face thing. It was a bit odd.
Yeah, well, this is it. Late night in London. You can't separate fiction from reality. But anyway, thus far, I haven't dressed up as anything. You'll be relieved to know. It's not an image anyone needs to see, is it?
Well, yeah, you didn't even dress up as yourself, put on the old
grey... No, I've just been naked all weekend.
The grey tracksuit pants, the old J-Train logo here or there.
I'm sure a few people have gone as that to various Halloween parties, but I'm not including myself in that.
Yes, yes. Fair enough. So, good weekend, generally. It was the Dublin Marathon here yesterday.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did you watch from the sidelines?
No, I ran it.
No, did you?
No, I didn't. I did go along to cheer on a couple of mates who were running in it. So the 16-mile mark was just up the road from my house. So we went out and cheered them on, gave them a few high fives as they were going, get that boost for the final 10 miles. I think they said
so
that
way.
Yeah, that's what
it's all down to you.
Yeah. I think we basically were we did all the hard work. You know, they just had to run. And, you know, we were there to cheer them on. But no, it was a good day. Great atmosphere, actually. It was brilliant to see all the people out there cheering on all the runners. 19,000-something people running for 26 miles, 385 yards. The absolute lunatics.
Did it make you think, oh, I fancy giving that a crack?
No. I mean, just no. Definitely not. It's too long. Right. Far too long for me. You know, 4 hours, 4.5 hours of running. You know, I'm sure it's a great achievement and everything else, but the amount of training you have to do and then you have to do the thing, no, just definitely not for me. I couldn't.
I think I'm inclined to agree.
Yeah. So look, it's been a pretty good weekend. You know, apart from zombie apocalypse being upon us and crazy people running very far, but generally speaking, it's been a good weekend from an Arsenal point of view.
Yeah, very good weekend. I mean, I guess the zombies are the Sunderland defence, am I right?
Oh, yeah, nicely done.
And the marathon runners, Mohamed Elneny in the Arsenal midfield, covering all the ground. Really good weekend. I mean, I say that. I don't know about the broader results. I mean, look, I enjoyed Manchester United failing to win again.
That was good. I, you know, I there's part of me that's enjoying it. And there's another part of me that's going, we're playing them in a few weeks' time, and I'm not, I just can't, I can't commit to fully enjoying it already, you know, until such time as we get a result against them and against him. There's just this nagging doubt in the back of my mind. Like, there's part of me going, I really should be just, like, taking it as it comes and enjoying it for what it is in the moment without contextualizing it in an Arsenal context, right? But then there's just this nagging doubt. This thing, like, somehow he'll manage to make something happen against us, and, you know, obviously I hope that doesn't.
I hope that doesn't.
But I suppose in the very short term we can enjoy it. The fact he was sent off as well, that was funny.
Yeah, lovely to see. Really was. But I think you are right. I mean, we all remember what happened when Arsenal played David Moyes' Manchester United and we sort of failed to beat them over the course of two games. So, yeah, I mean, I guess some pause for consideration there. But apart from that, it was a good weekend. And Arsenal, I mean, beat one of the worst teams I've seen in a while in the Premier League.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes you can look at a team and go, yeah, there's probably a reason why the results aren't going their way. Maybe they've been a bit unlucky, or maybe they're missing some key players, or you can see just they're not getting the rub of the green. You know that there's some potential there. There's the possibility that things might get better. And you look at that Sunderland team, that collection of players, and it's just like, oh, you're fucked. Like, there's no way around it. They're completely fucked. And I don't even think it's all to do with Moyes, to be perfectly honest. You know, he has shown himself to be a competent manager, if not a brilliant manager, but generally speaking, a fairly competent Premier League manager. And you look at those players and you think, fuck, there's just no way. Half of them didn't give a shit, you know?
No, I mean, that doesn't help when you just sort of can't be bothered to try or run. Mm. But also when you look at the 11, 1 to 11, I mean, it's not good, is it? I mean, it's very rare that you can look at a Premier League side and say, that's not a very good team. You know, because there's a lot of good footballers in this division now. Even in the lower reaches, there's some really top players. But when you look at Sunderland, I mean, you can't really see any that stand out.
No, you look at it, yeah, it's like a team of absolute journeymen, isn't it? And I was looking at the bench and I was thinking, well, do they have anything on the bench that might causes a problem? And you're Victor Anichebe, you're going, Jesus God, you know, he's just like, this is his life, this is what he is now, just a football player. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but, you know, it's like, oh man, if you're a Sunderland fan, you'd be so downhearted, wouldn't you? Because it just, you can't see how it's going to get any better.
No. I mean, they've got some players. They've got a player called Love on the bench and a player called Gooch, which I enjoyed.
Love Gooch.
Love Gooch. But yeah, they're done for, aren't they? I mean, they're 2 points. It's got 2 points all season from 10 games. It would take something truly remarkable. I know there's talk about Fat Sam waiting in the wings and what have you, but I don't think even he would be able to haul them from to safety.
Oh, really? There's some talk about Allardyce coming back.
Yeah.
But I mean, how much are Sunderland fans going to enjoy that? The guy who walked out on them, you know, to go to England. I guess they'd understand that, you know. But I mean, you get, like I said, you get someone like David Moyes in, and you would think, okay, chances are he could get this team to like the middle of the bottom half of mid table, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You would think, but no, they're just terrible. And typically, we sort of, we let them back into it, in a way.
Well, that was the sort of frustrating thing. I mean, we scored, obviously, in the first half. A brilliant goal. A goal I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
I hear a goal that you are at least partially responsible, a bit like the marathon, partially responsible for.
Yes. Yeah. Actually, yeah, because there was a bit on Friday's Arsecast where I was saying, if I were talking to Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, I would tell him, you know, don't cross it all the way to the other side of the pitch, you know, towards the other corner flag. Put it in a more dangerous area, you know, between the six-yard box and the penalty spot. Whip it in there with some pace. And lo and behold, that's exactly what he did. And Alexis Sanchez was there to make the most of that cross. A great cross, a great move. Lots of passes in the move. A great cross from Oxlade-Chamberlain. A great header from Alexis Sanchez. But abject defending. Like, if you were that centre half, you'd probably just say, fuck, sorry, I'm retiring. I, you know, that's over for me now. He was terrible. So without wanting to take anything away from the quality of the goal that we scored, it really was dreadful defending.
Yeah, he just let Sanchez run across him completely and head it pretty much unchallenged, which is crazy given, you know, the fact they're both in the penalty box. But I always get a kick out of Alexis scoring a header. There's something about the fact that he's not the biggest guy and the way he's got that spring, and he's pretty, pretty good in the air for someone of his size. So I always enjoy those.
Yeah, he does score a few headers all right, doesn't he?
Yeah. But anyway, at that stage, really, the gulf was about as wide as it ever gets in the Premier League.
Mm.
And Arsenal, you know, should have put the game to bed. I'm trying to think if we had clear-cut chances we should have scored.
Yeah, there was Mesut Ozil's one where the ball was played over the top again beautifully by Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, and he had the chance to lob the keeper, but under-hit the lob a bit.
Well, I wonder if the bounce of the pitch was a little bit of an issue for him. I think it maybe came up a little close to him. And that was a problem throughout the whole game. Sunderland didn't water the pitch, and it later cost us, I suppose, with their equaliser, Mustafi slipping up.
Well, true, actually, yeah. And I noticed that from the very start. I think I even said it in the live blog, is that the pitch looks extremely slow. So Arsenal were passing the ball, and the ball was, like, you know, trickling along the pitch. And I guess teams are fully entitled to do what they want with their own pitch. You know, when you're playing a team that thrives on slick passing and moving the ball quickly, if you can do something to prevent that to a certain extent, then why wouldn't you? Especially if you were Sunderland and you're in the kind of position they're in. But yeah, it definitely had an effect on the equaliser. But of course, before that, we should have had a penalty when Alexis Sanchez burst through ahead of, I think it was your pal, wasn't it, Djilibodji? Who hauled him down, and I just don't understand why that wasn't a penalty.
No. I mean, what was the referee's view of it like? What was the angle like? Do you know off the top of your head?
I mean, I'm guessing he was looking at... Sanchez would have been the far side of Djilibodji.
Yeah.
So whether he saw it was the left hand of the defender. So whether he saw it, I don't know. It looked like he had a pretty good view of it, albeit, you know, looking at it sort of slightly side on, but nailed on penalty. And of course, it's very frustrating when you have missed chances and you are maybe struggling to put the game to bed when something like that happens, and then they go up the other end and score immediately afterwards. It's like, oh God, here we go.
Well, I think that compounded the frustration, didn't it? I mean, it was literally one end to the other, and they got the penalty kick. I mean, I agree entirely. We should have had a spot kick, and that could have settled the game then and there. Any complaints at all about the award for the Sunderland penalty?
No, it was a foul. It was a foul by Cech, and I think, you know, twice now we've been, I won't say lucky, but maybe last year that would have been a red card for Petr Cech.
Oh, I think definitely, yeah. I think there's been one of those much-discussed directives about that particular type of incident. And I wonder if Cech knew that as well, do you know what I mean? I wonder if he thought, oh, I'll take my chances.
Yeah.
Because he sort of made it look as if he was ducking out of the challenge by turning his shoulder, but the contact was was there, very much there nonetheless. And Jermaine Defoe put the penalty away. Cech had done his homework, went the same way as Defoe's last few, but Cech put it down the middle. And I was absolutely fuming at that point in the game.
Really? Gone
yeah,
mad.
Because I was so frustrated that a side who'd been so short of us in terms of quality and even possession, you know, barely in the game, was suddenly level. I felt like we'd really allowed them back in. And generally, in that scenario, when a home team, I mean, Arsene Wenger's talked about this in the aftermath of the game, when a home team comes back to equalise, most of the time, they're the ones who are going to go on and win that, you know, because they've got the momentum, they've got the crowd. But fortunately, Sunderland are a special case.
Yeah, I mean, I did. I mean, I think everybody probably would have been worried. I mean, there was still plenty of time to go, but we've been in this scenario before where we've dominated a game and all of a sudden we're level when we should have been miles ahead. And it does have an effect, I think, on the players. You know, they've been through it enough times. But Arsene Wenger spoke after the game about character. He spoke about the ability of his team to bounce back from a disappointing result, which was the game against Borough the previous weekend, and then the disappointment of being brought back on level terms by Sunderland, and the response, you have to say, was pretty much emphatic. 3 goals in 6.5 minutes or 7 minutes, something like that.
Wow, it's quicker than that.
Yeah.
I wonder, I mean, it's almost, do you think there's a case that the goal, Arsenal kind of needed the goal almost to kind of kick them into life, you know?
Maybe. I mean, I guess you would, yeah, you could say that, but I think it was just one of those things, and the response could have been very different. We might not have been able to find a goal. We might have struggled to break them down. We might have conceded another one. I just think you have to look at it on its own merits. Mm. That, you know, we put the pressure on, and once that second goal went in, Sunderland just capitulated completely. You know,
Of course, Olivier Giroud was instrumental to that, wasn't he? 2 goals with his first 2 touches.
Yeah, that's, I mean, fantastic. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure the Opta guys and the stats guys probably have put something up over the weekend about this, but, I can't remember that happening before. I don't remember an Arsenal player coming off the bench and scoring with his first 2 touches. The last time I can remember an Arsenal player coming off the bench and scoring with his first touch, do you know the goal I'm thinking of?
I'm thinking of Nicholas Bentner, of course.
Correct. Yes, what a brilliant goal that was. So he's running on. We're about to take a corner. He runs onto the pitch, runs into the area. I think it was Cesc Fabregas who took the corner, and he thumped a header home against Tottenham. So that's the last time I can remember that happening. Maybe it has happened, and it hasn't been quite as decisive in a game. But, I mean, what a great finish it was. He swept the ball in. This is a guy that's been out for like a good part of the season. He looked very sharp. He looks fit and lean and quite beardy. And it was a really, really good finish, as was the second one. The second one is like absolutely brilliant header. I think maybe the keeper should have done better with it, but it was just one of those that looped perfectly in the right area. So, I mean, what an impact, you know, for the guy to come on and having missed as much of the season as he's missed and you know, for people still to sort of doubt him a little bit as well. I think that's tremendous. It was great for him. It was great for us.
Yeah, I mean, the first goal was very good. Slightly behind him, the ball, and he adjusted brilliantly to kind of side foot it into the far corner. But the header, Ozil's delivery was good, and it seemed to be almost a training ground routine. You know, the run was perfect to meet it, but it looped into the far corner so perfectly that I was like, well, that can't be on purpose. That must have taken a nick of someone's shoulder or something. But then to see it on the replay, I mean, it'd be absolutely deliberate. I agree the keeper might have done better, but it's a superb header. And, a real demonstration of Giroud's quality, really. And, that, you know, you felt in his celebrations, there was almost that thing of, you know, I'm back. Don't forget about me. And interesting as well, I mean, the analysis of football, I think sometimes we're all guilty of oversimplifying it. But after the Middlesbrough game, almost everybody said, well, we missed someone with the presence of Olivier Giroud could come on and change the match. And then that pattern, you know, happened in the next game.
Yeah.
I think we saw what tremendous value he brings to the squad.
Absolutely. I mean, I think he's always been a player who's capable of having an impact from the bench as well. You know, certain players just can't do it or find it difficult to get into the rhythm of a game, whereas Giroud is very quick to do that sometimes. There was a period last season when he was being kept off out of the starting 11 by Theo Walcott up front, and I think he scored from the bench in 4 games within, you know, a few weeks, including ones against goal against Bayern Munich as well. So, you know, a big game, he got into the rhythm of the game and found a way to make an impact. So it's absolutely fantastic. We also saw a return for Aaron Ramsey, which I have to say I'm delighted about, because I really like Aaron Ramsey as a player. But I loved the completely accidental creativity he showed in the build-up to the fourth goal.
Well, for a start, I didn't even know he was on the pitch because I think the TV broadcast here missed him coming on.
Yeah.
So there was that whole surprise element to it. And, yeah, the accidental creativity. I mean, it was sort of 2 occasions, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because first, he tried to turn his man and it became a pass for Kieran Gibbs, who then struck the post. And then when the ball came back to Ramsey, I'm not sure how... What was it? Was it a shot he had?
I think as the ball was rebounding out, he just stuck his foot out to try and direct it back towards goal, and it became a pass to Alexis, who then finished it absolutely brilliantly. I loved the finish of that. Like, whatever about stepping inside the defender, the way that he just poked it past the keeper was absolutely superb. But it was like totally brilliant accidental creativity from Aaron Ramsey. He had no intention to do either of those things, I don't think. But you know, what can you say? A good way to make an impact. I suppose it will go down as an assist for him. So yeah, good to see him
absolutely.
Back.
Absolutely. And what position was he playing? Do we think he was playing? Was he playing on the right hand side? Vaguely.
Your guess is as good as mine.
Yeah,
I don't know. I think he probably was a little bit, because he came on for Oxlade-Chamberlain. But I don't.
I think he probably then switched in field when Maitland-Niles came on very late on, but. He was sort of doing that Ramsey thing where it's sort of unclear.
Yeah. Where are you? What are you doing? Who are you supposed to be? Yeah, so I don't know. When you're 3-4-1 up then in the last few minutes, I'm not sure positional discipline is the order of the day. Had we been trying to hang on to a one-goal lead, maybe we would have had a better idea. But look, just good to see him back. And obviously now midfield becomes... a crowded place again, because Granit Xhaka is back, Aaron Ramsey is back, Coquelin, I thought, played well against against Sunderland. I thought Mohamed Elneny was absolutely fantastic as well. Santi Cazorla, I don't know what the situation with him is in terms of his injury, but you know, we've got all these midfield options again, and it probably won't be a case that too many cooks spoil the broth, you know, trying to figure out how to fit everybody in. But, I'd much rather have this situation than just have, you know, two fit central midfielders or available central midfielders. So great to see him back.
Yeah, and also, Austin's already talking up the possibility of playing Ramsey on the flanks. I don't know how seriously he's considering it, but with that wealth of central midfield options, it must be something that's on the table. It's a bit disconcertingly vague about Cazorla, isn't it? We haven't heard much at all, really, about that injury.
Yeah. Yeah. I do wonder if they're being extra cautious, because he had a big Achilles problem last season, and that was what kept him out. After he had the knee injury, it was an Achilles problem that kept him out for such a long time as well. So if he's taken a kick, or if it's aggravated something that was perhaps he was managing... You know, I'm not sure anyone who's had Achilles problems will know that they don't tend to, like, fully go away. You can manage your training. You can manage to play through a certain amount of discomfort. But if he's aggravated something and it's particularly sore again, it could be a bit of a worry, all right. But, you know, when you've got Xhaka, when you've got Ramsey, Coquelin and Elneny who can fill in there, it's not quite as... It's not quite as worrisome. Obviously, you want Cazorla available, but I think we've got the depth to cope.
Yeah, and you mentioned Elneny. I thought he was really excellent. Completed about 90-odd passes. And when you look back at that, you know, move for the first goal, which is 21 passes or so, he'll be in there several times. He really showed great vision on several occasions. He's got that fantastic engine. I feel like he's a player who's particularly useful away from home. You know, there's something about the way he plays that just seems to fit that strategic setup. I think he was terrific. So it'll be really interesting to see what the manager does over the next week. Obviously, we go away in the Champions League, but then a very, very big game at the weekend. So maybe he'll look to rotate it a little again.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think he's going to do for tomorrow night? Because obviously we beat them 6-0 in the first game. But it wasn't necessarily as comfortable as a 6-0 scoreline would suggest. You know, the first half, David Ospina was called into action a number of times. But for some very good interventions by him, they might have scored. So I think, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how much he changes things around. I think he'll go pretty strong tomorrow night, to be honest.
Well, you know, at least the game was Saturday lunchtime as opposed to, you know, Sunday afternoon. It's a Tuesday as opposed to a Wednesday, with the Spurs game being on a Sunday as opposed to a Saturday.
Yeah.
As kind as the fixture list could be, it has been. So I think there'll be a few changes. I wonder if maybe there'll be more in the attacking departments. I wonder if Olivier Giroud might get himself a start after a couple of substitute appearances. But I wouldn't expect many changes at the back. I think the back four will be pretty much intact, and probably Coquelin and Elneny have a very good chance to play as well.
Mm, do you think? I think he might do something in midfield. I think he might bring Xhaka back, or I think maybe he might be a bit cautious still with Aaron Ramsey about starting him.
Yeah. Xhaka would be the one, I think. I'd be surprised if Ramsey started this soon. I don't think there's any chance of Ramsey starting, say, the Spurs game at the weekend. So there's not necessarily a big imperative to get him ready for that match. So
yeah.
I think, yeah, if someone comes in, it's more likely to be Xhaka.
Okay, so if he starts Giroud up top tomorrow, who makes way?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting one, isn't it? But I mean, it's an interesting debate full stop with the whole Giroud Alexis thing. As regards tomorrow, I suppose I would think Alexis maybe, but he's not going to be happy about that.
No, I mean, yeah, is he starting Giroud to rest Alexis ahead of Sunday, or simply to give Giroud a game? He did say specifically that Giroud and Sanchez can play together, but Sanchez would have to move wide. Like, could he move Sanchez back out to the left where Alex Iwobi has been playing?
He could do, but I feel like, for me, I suppose the point of fielding Giroud, I know he's a very different player to Alexis, would be to afford Alexis that rest ahead of the Spurs game. Now, whether or not Arsene feels he needs that, I don't know. Obviously, that also changes the attacking dynamic of the team significantly. But I just wonder, with Theo Walcott possibly out, I mean, we don't really know much about his injury situation. I know that, I think we were told he could be back for Tuesday, weren't we?
Yeah, there was some suggestion he could be all right, yeah.
Yeah, so he should be okay for Spurs. But I just think they'll be maybe a bit cautious with Alexis. But that was the interesting thing about the Giroud. I mean, you know, he came on, he scored two goals. And ordinarily in a situation like that, you might think, oh, you know, is this guy the player we should be building our attack around? But the guy who we are building our attack around, Alexis, also nabbed himself a brace. It was a question of plan A and plan B both working pretty well.
Does that then give him does it clarify anything in his mind, or does it give him a bigger headache?
For me, it clarifies it, because Alexis started and that worked. You know, Alexis was effective, and Giroud came off the bench and that worked. So, to my mind, those roles are kind of, confirmed by what happened. What about you?
I'm not sure. You know, I think what's been really interesting and exciting about the team this season is the way that we've been playing and the way that we've set up from an attacking point of view. And I don't want to say that playing Giroud completely undoes that, because I don't think it does. He's a guy who's been part of some of our best performances, in the seasons that he's been here. It's not like we've never played well with Giroud in the side. You know, that's not the case at all. But, yeah, I mean, he's got to give him games. I don't think he can be a super sub the entire season.
Mm-hmm.
And he also has to balance Alexis and the effort that he puts in into the games, perhaps where we might need him most. And you'd look at Sunday's game against Spurs as one where, like, a fully fit, raring to go Alexis, perhaps slightly frustrated Alexis, you know, that he didn't get on in midweek or was left out in midweek. You know, maybe that's the thing. But, you know, I look at Alex Iwobi, I thought he was very quiet against Sunderland. I thought he had a quiet game the previous week too. I just wonder, are there signs that he's a guy who could possibly benefit from being taken out of the firing line just a little bit, to let him refocus and find his way again? Not that he's like gone off track or anything, but he is still a very young player, and he's sort of having a little bit of a fluctuation in terms of his form. So that was why I was wondering where you think he might make the change if he brings Giroud in. So
my problem is, if I'm minded to give Giroud a game, partly to give Alexis a rest, I feel like if you end up putting Alexis wide, he's probably covering more ground in that position than he is at centre forward, you know, just in terms of tracking back and what have you, and the way he works on that flank. So I don't know. Do you think Giroud will play this game? It just seems to me like it's an opportunity for him to start a match which may not be particularly forthcoming in other areas over the next few weeks.
Yeah, maybe so. I mean, you could make a good case for it, all right. And there's no question that I think the team selection for tomorrow night will be informed slightly by what's coming up on Sunday, even if we do have, you know, plenty of days between the Champions League fixture and Sunday, you can't not take that into consideration. I think he said something about that earlier, actually. You know, he'll... Well, let me see if I can find the quote here. Boom, ba-dum, boom, boom. Here he is. He's talking about... with Xhaka back, I have to analyse all that now. We play in the Champions League and then we play Tottenham, so I have to see who I rest and who I play without diminishing the chance of the team to win the game. So it's clear he's thinking about freshening things up for sure. So yeah, Giroud up top is one of those fairly obvious ones, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And look, Spurs have got Bayer Leverkusen on Wednesday. I think that's a big game for them. You know, I think they've got 4 points, Bayer have got three in that group. So they won't be able to rest many for that particular match, and they'll have a day's less recovery. So we've got that in our favour, at least.
All right. OK, well, that's that. Looking ahead to that. Anything else from the weekend catch your eye, tickle your fancy?
I mean, I mentioned Spurs. I enjoyed Leicester rediscovering some of their form from last season to get a point there.
Yeah,
at White Hart Lane. That was enjoyable. Just trying to think up and down the leagues, really. I mean, that was kind of it. I enjoyed... Did you see Crystal Palace, Liverpool? That was a game beautifully bereft of defending.
No, I didn't see any of that. That was yesterday, no?
Saturday evening.
Saturday evening, right.
Yeah, that was a fun one.
No.
Because simply nobody really knew how to defend anything at all. so that made it for a very, very entertaining spectacle.
What was the result of that one? Did Liverpool win?
4-2 to Liverpool.
4-2 Liverpool, Jesus.
So Liverpool sit joint top. Well, joint top. They're third, we're second, Man City first, all on 23 points, Chelsea behind on 22. It's incredibly tight and very exciting, really. I mean, you know, I haven't got a clue what's going
to
happen.
No, I don't think anyone does. And I guess it speaks to the competitiveness of the league in general. But of course, there are only 10 games. I think we'll start to see things stretch. You know, top four, top five, stretching away from the rest. I mean, there's a top six there now, really, isn't there? So Everton are only 2 points off Tottenham, and then starting to be a bit of a gap. So hopefully we can extend that gap over Manchester United and Tottenham as the month of November. Hang on, no. November!
Yeah, exactly. For this Halloween, I'm coming dressed as Arsenal's November.
Oh, God. So you're just dressing as a big pile of shit.
Yeah, basically. I mean, it is a daunting fixture list, isn't it? Spurs on the 6th, then it's the international break, then it's Manchester United away, PSG, then a relatively welcome tie at home to Bournemouth, and then we finish with Southampton in the League Cup.
Mm.
So, yeah, but I mean, those Spurs, United and PSG games, absolutely mammoth, really.
Yeah, they really are. Okay, well, look, we'll obviously wait and see how we get on with those. We're going to take a short break here now. We're going to come back with part two and your questions right after this.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog.
Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is the part of the show where we answer the questions that you send to us on Twitter at GunnarBlog and at ArsBlog, or on Facebook. Check out the Facebook page, facebook.com/TheArsBlog. James, I'm going to go first with the questions.
Oh, go on.
Yeah. This one is from Brendan Dean at 2D2Eno. God. That was much more difficult to say than it should have been. Anyway, he wanted to know, what did you make of Jack Wilshere's comments? Do you think he was a little bit foolish, given he's been forever injured? In the context of this, is saying that being left out of the England squad by Sam Allardyce was the final straw for him, at which point he demanded a move to play regular football.
Yeah, I mean, I found that a really fascinating interview to read, and one that shed, you know, a lot of light. If you haven't seen it, I think it's a piece, I'm afraid to say, with the Daily Mail.
Ooh.
But it shed quite a lot of light on how his move exactly came to pass, you know, the interaction between him and Arsene Wenger in the build-up to the transfer window, and his attitude on the move. And I came away from it really feeling like he doesn't sound like a player in much of a hurry to come back. I mean, in a much more definite way than a lot of other loanees we've had in recent seasons, he sounds... I don't know. I came away from it thinking, I don't know if I see Jack Wilshere at Arsenal again. It made the switch sound very permanent to me. Was that your impression?
Slightly. I mean, I think the thing that I took away from it more than anything was just the lack of understanding about why maybe he wasn't picked for the England squad. And about why he wasn't starting for Arsenal after two, three games of the season. You spent the whole of last season injured. You went to the European Championships not fit by your own admission. It's got to take some time. I think there was a very interesting line. He said there was already a lot of midfielders, and then he bought another one, as if somehow it was a slight to Jack Wilshere. But maybe Wilshere read into it what he wanted to read into it, that, you know, oh, well, left-footed midfielder coming in, playing in the position where I'd like to play, and he's paid £35 million for him. Maybe that tells Jack Wilshere what Arsene Wenger thinks, you know. But just the lack of general understanding about his own situation, about the reality of his situation, not whatever version of it that's going on in his head, but the reality. If you were to step back and examine it, look, you played in a couple of the games. You came on as a substitute. Work hard, train hard, stay fit, get in the team and stay in the team. And I think, as we said it here on the podcast, I've said it on the blog, I think he took, I wouldn't say an easy option, but I think he took a step down, and I don't think it's going to be easy for him to make the step back up. I think it's going to become very difficult for him to do that. Whereas he could have, if he'd stayed in a midfield at Arsenal, that was kind of in flux, right? It's not like there's definite... We still don't know who's going to play in midfield from game to game. So the chance is there to make your mark and to work hard and get into it. And I found it, it was quite informative for me that he chose to leave rather than stay and fight.
Yeah, and especially because I remember in those first few games of the season, it felt to me like Arsene was making quite a concerted effort to include him. You know, he came off the bench, he was getting minutes, and I remember thinking, this is typical of Arsene, because whenever Wilshere is fit, he does seem to make a real push for him to be in the side. Obviously, not being in the England squad really hurt him, and to me, that also, as an Arsenal fan above an England fan, that rankles slightly. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I know it's kind of a reflection of how you're playing, but I kind of think you've got to play for your club first. That's got to be the priority, your paymasters. But yeah, I mean, do you think if he'd stayed, he would have had a shot at establishing himself in the Arsenal side? We talked about the sheer wealth of options Arsene Wenger's got in that area at the top of the show. Do you think he could have done something here?
Sure, why not? You know, if he, yeah, I mean, look, he's got quality and talent and all those kind of things. And like you say, Arsene Wenger is prepared to give him a chance. Maybe he would have had to be a bit patient. But, you know, a Xhaka suspension and a Cazorla injury opens the door for Wilshere, you know, to come back in. And I think he would have played in EFL Cup. I think he would have got minutes as a substitute. And then it was on him. You could say there were similarities between his situation and that of Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, right? That he was a guy over whom there were a lot of doubts, that he was not in any way and still isn't in any way assured of a starting position in the team. But when given the chances, has got to show that he's got what it takes. And Oxlade-Chamberlain, to his credit, is producing this season far more than he ever has. And he's taken a step forward because he's knuckled down, he's worked hard. So, you know, I think Wilshere would have had chances. Whether he took them or not is another question. And if he was so unhappy with his situation, he could have gone on loan in January. Could have, like, okay, I'm here, it's January, I'm not playing anywhere near as much as I would like, I want to go on loan. And I think, Arsenal would have let that happen. If they let it happen in August, they would have let it happen in January. And as I said at the time, I think when a club deems you expendable, then you're on a slippery slope, I think. So, yeah, I don't think the comments were particularly well judged from Wilshere, to be honest.
I also think you mentioned Oxlade-Chamberlain as a parallel, but Theo Walcott is also potentially a parallel. You know, a guy who suffered a lot of injury problems and wasn't part of the first team, and he came back after the summer with a transformed attitude and has, against the odds almost, established himself as an important part of the first team. So it is possible to do that. I think telling too that Wilshere talks about, you know, we had a lot of midfielders and Arsene went and bought another one in a summer in which Mathieu Flamini, Mikel Arteta and Tomáš Rosický all left the club. You know, it's not like there wasn't an opportunity for other midfielders to stake a claim there. So, yeah, I came away from it thinking, well, if he really feels that way and has that sense of entitlement, I guess, about the fact that he should be playing, then maybe it is better for him to be at a club where he's going to be first choice week in, week out, because at the moment, you know, it doesn't feel like that's going to be Arsenal.
All right, next question.
Next question, yeah. Sorry, I was quite engrossed there. let's have a look. So, Rob Hull. Rob says, with Alexis banging goals in, Giroud coming off the bench to bag a brace at the weekend, Lucas Perez looking sharp until his injury, and Dat Guy Welbs due back in 2 months, have Arsenal now incredibly become too striker heavy?
No. Because Lucas Perez is out for 2 months. Danny Welbeck, if he's back in January, you know, it's still going to take him, what? When you think of all the football that Danny Welbeck has missed over the last couple of seasons, it's going to take him probably till next season to be properly, truly unfit, on form, with the rhythm that you need to be as effective as you can be. So, you know, I it's a shame. I think the Lucas injury is a real shame because he provided us with that extra bit of depth and quality and a bit of craft and experience as well. You know, he's 28 years of age, so, you know, he's a pretty smart player. So I think that's a bit of a blow, to be honest. But I don't think we can be too striker heavy. You know, Alexis and Giroud are doing it. Well, Giroud's only just started doing it. Obviously, Alexis is having a fantastic season, a really brilliant season so far. But no, I don't think we could say we're too striker heavy. If they were all fit and all available, then perhaps it might cause Arsene Wenger a problem. But for now, no, I don't think so. What about you?
I mean, I think it's a great situation. It feels like such a transformation from when it felt like it was only Giroud for so long. And obviously Alexis kind of shifting his roles played a part in that. But I agree, Lucas has looked sharp. The guy I'd be cursing his luck at the moment, I guess, is Tuber Akpom, who might have had, with Lucas out, an opportunity for the odd game here and there. Certainly in the Capital One Cup, EFL Cup as it's now called, the other night you would have had a chance. But it sounds like he's got a relatively serious back injury. So
yeah.
We you know, he's missing out, unfortunately.
Mm, I saw somebody on Facebook the other day. We did a story about that on Arsblog News, and this guy was in the comments suggesting that it was all a conspiracy, that Akpom wasn't injured at all, and this was just Wenger's way of getting Olivier Giroud back into the team. People are fucking mad, aren't they?
I think so. I must say, I don't know anything about the fitness status of Yaya Sanogo, but I think he is also injured as well. So,
I think I read on... Could have been on Reddit, on the Gunners subreddit there, somebody saying that they saw Yaya Sanogo in the gym. Like, they go, whatever, what's a chain of gyms that you've got in the UK? Do you know?
Oh, I don't know. Virgin Active?
No, wasn't that.
My gym's just called The Gym.
The Gym?
Yeah, right. That's the name of the brand of gym.
Okay.
I don't know, but they saw him actually in a gym, did they?
Yeah, in a gym. Yeah, just doing his shit. So I don't know. Maybe there was just no room at the Arsenal gym that day, or maybe he's doing some extra training. I don't know, but I think it doesn't really matter, to be honest.
I think you're right now. And I think it's great that we've got a variety of striking options. And to be honest, it is a real blow to lose Lucas, but it's slightly balanced out, isn't it, by Giroud coming back to fitness. So, yeah.
All right, here's a question coming from a couple of people, actually. One is Adam, at Adam Arsenal, who says, does Kieran Gibbs now deserve to start? I've been really impressed with his performances and mentality. And that's also backed up by Gagan J, who wants to know, who would be your first choice left back against Spurs if Monreal is fit again? So what's going on there? What do you reckon?
Oh, dear. I really sighed there. Like, I was really stressing myself over the left-back situation. I think Kieran Gibbs has been great in the last few games. I thought he was very good against Ludogorets. I thought he was good against Reading again. And then I thought he was very good at Sunderland. Now, I suppose what unites those games is it's not necessarily the stiffest competition that we might face. I also wonder as well how much it's got to do with who's in front of him, a subject that we've talked about, you know, on this podcast several times. But maybe he's been a little bit more protected than Monreal. But I think, for me, I'm a massive Nacho Monreal fan. I thought last season he really was one of our players of the season, absolutely outstanding. But I think if you want to protect the meritocratic nature of the squad and you want to give that sense of competition, I think it's very, very tempting to stick with Gibbs because he's barely put a foot wrong, to be honest, since he's come in. So I might be inclined to keep him there and let Nacho kind of earn his place. I'm sure there'll be plenty of opportunities for him to do that. But for now, I think maybe he deserves to stay in the side. What do you reckon?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. He has been good. But I just feel like Monreal's... I know he's had some difficult games this season, but I think generally speaking his consistency has been absolutely fantastic. So I'd be a bit more inclined to just stick with him because of that. But I think it's a good it's a good situation. When Gibbs is coming in and he's been given a chance like others, he's knuckled down, he's worked hard, he's shown we talked about him being adequate backup the other week, didn't we? So he's proving to be more than adequate in that regard, that his performances have been good. I just think maybe Monreal is a little bit better on the ball. I think he gives us a little bit more. And I think, you know, if Monreal had played against Sunderland, for example, you know, he would have had a relatively... solid performance the same way Gibbs did, because there was little or no threat apart from that guy. What was his name? Kasri?
The guy
who would, like, his crossing was worse than Oxlade-Chamberlain's was. He just kept hitting them over the bar and out for goal kicks and stuff. So I don't think Gibbs had an awful lot to contend with. When it comes to Sunderland, so you know, his performance was reflected on that, you know. But I would go to Gibbs or to Monreal for Spurs.
Okay, well, let's hope he's fit for a start. James Powell asked this on Facebook, but a few other people asked it on Twitter too. Mm-hmm. And he says, on Match of the Day on Saturday, Alan Shearer claimed that Sergio Aguero is the only world-class player in the Premier League. Do you agree? And if not, who would be on your list?
this is one of those weird ones, isn't it? Because there's no actual, what is the definition of world class? It seems, it seems to change. You know, it's not like, okay, tick all of these boxes and you are a world class player. I don't think there's any doubt that Sergio Aguero is a brilliant, brilliant footballer, a great striker. Like, if world class is Lionel Messi, then there are very few other world class players in the world.
Exactly.
So it's difficult. But look, by the very general or broad spectrum of that term that people use, Aguero would be, let's say, a world class player. But, you know, I think, based on what we've seen this season, Alexis Sanchez is that too. Mesut Ozil is. You know, these are the guys who are the big stars in the Premier League. If you're looking for guys who can do it week in, week out consistently, and who provide excitement and quality in games, then certainly our two boys have some of that. I mean, there must be other players at other teams. Perhaps I'm refusing to give them any real credit. you know, but there must be guys. I mean, Aguero is one of the best players in the league. Like, if you were to pick the top 10 players in the league, he would be in there. But then so would Ozil and so would Alexis Sanchez. Like, yeah, Lauren Koscielny.
That was the name I was going to throw in. I can't think of many centre-halves in world football who's superior to him.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but again, it's like, well, is he world-class compared to Sergio Aguero? Or, you know, based on the fact that he is one of the most consistent central defenders in Europe, that all the opposition seem to say he's a nightmare to play against. He's very difficult to play against. So, you know, it's trying to find out what is that definition. But if Sergio Aguero is it, then Koscielny, Alexis, Ozil, who else? I mean, I don't want to go through all the teams in the league. It seems like a pain in the hole.
Yeah.
Wayne Rooney, of course, you know.
Rooney, obviously, yeah. Kasri,
yeah. World-class at hitting.
Gilibodji.
Yeah, all those guys. Names. Yeah, exactly. But, I think it's a ridiculous statement to make to say there's only one world-class player in the Premier League. But then it was Alan Shearer, so...
That's it. I mean, we can't be too surprised, can we?
No, I don't think we can. I don't think we can.
No.
Yeah.
There aren't many world-class pundits on British television. That's,
oh, my God. Did you see the Jamie Redknapp story?
I don't know if I did.
During the Chelsea game at the weekend, Jamie Redknapp said, hang on, there's a quote here. I'm going to have to...
Yes, I did hear this. You've reminded me.
That it's great to see young English talent like Victor Moses get a chance. Good to see young English talent getting a chance. Victor Moses is 25 years of age and is a Nigerian international.
Yeah.
I mean, for fuck's sake. I know we...
It's good to see.
I know, but you know what, though? We sit here, and I know pressures of live television and all those kind of things, and, you know, maybe it's not as easy a job as we like to make it out. But if you're being paid a shitload of money to what I suppose give your expertise on the game of football for viewers to improve, to enhance the viewing experience. And if you don't know that a guy who's been playing in the Premier League for what? How long? Like, Victor Moses was at Wigan, right? So,
He's been at Crystal Palace, Wigan. Yeah, he's been around.
So he's been a Premier League player for 5-6 years at least.
Mm.
And if you're sitting there and you're telling people he's English, young English talent, and he's a Nigerian international, I mean, that's bullshit. He should have his wages docked for that. Like, maybe they could do what they do with referees. When referees make a mistake, they get demoted, you know, to do a game in League Two or the Championship or something like that. So maybe Jamie Redknapp would have to, I don't know, he'd have to be, I don't know, a fluffer on a porn set or something. I don't know. Go work on Dancing with the Stars. I don't know. Something terrible. But you should be made to pay for that.
Well, look, I mean, he wasn't alone. I mean, there was a few mistakes. I noticed Match of the Day on BBC twice saying that Olivier Giroud's goals against Sunderland were his first since scoring against Sunderland in January. completely forgetting goals. I think he scored at Man City, he scored a hat-trick against Aston Villa.
Yeah.
And they mentioned it twice. So
was that the
bizarre.
Commentator or the...
The commentator, yeah.
Right. And that's really weird because normally the commentators, if you see them, and some of them do it on Twitter, where they put up their, you know, they have their books. So they have all the names and they have all these facts and, you know, all little snippets in. So when Giroud gets the ball, you know, 64 caps for France, blah, 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 all these sort of things. So they have these little snippets and facts that they can throw in. So he obviously just didn't do his research, that guy.
No, or if he, maybe he didn't recognise Giroud with the beard. What do you make of that beard? Do you think he's taken it too far?
Is he taking it too far? No, I mean, I think he should grow it down beyond his belly button. Although it would be probably really easy to stop him. Like, whatever about having these skin tight shirts, so you can't really grip them as much. You know, if you could just grab a guy by the beard when you're running along. Could make it a bit difficult.
Yeah.
Imagine if, like, someone just wrenched off his beard. But
clean
no, I say grow it as much as you want, far as you like.
Okay, that'd be nice if he could score with his beard. That'd be good as well. You know, one off the top of the head and then one off the chin.
One off the beard.
I'd enjoy that.
That'd be good. All right, whose question is it? My question or your question?
It's your question.
Okay, here this one comes from Carl Pokorny at Carl_Pokorny. And he says, imagine for a second, just a second, that Spurs completed an invincible season but still finished fifth. Worth it for the lols?
Well, yeah. I mean, there was a few questions about this. So they are still unbeaten, aren't they? They're staggering along.
Mm.
A few draws along the way. But
a lot of draws.
I would say it's not for me. As funny as that would be to finish unbeaten and well short of the title, I feel like they'd still find a way to brag about that. So I would be against it. I want to preserve the integrity. For me, it's always a sweet moment in the season where every side's been beaten.
Mm.
I always take a bit of satisfaction from that. And of course, if they go season unbeaten, that means we've gone a season without beating them. So I'm never really going to sign up for that. So
oh,
I think,
oh yeah, good thinking.
It'll be a no from me. I'd like to see that whole idea put to bed as soon as Sunday. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, there is part of me that you know would enjoy the fact that they could only do what we did, but much worse.
Yeah.
You know, that even when they did do what we did, it didn't win them anything. That would be hilarious. But I think you're right. Yeah, the integrity of the achievement that we had in 2003, 2004 should be preserved. And obviously, if we can beat them along the way, then that makes it even better. I would prefer Spurs to finish fifth and also get beaten by us twice. So, yeah, I don't think it would be worth it. No.
No, let's hope the unbeaten run ends very, very, very soon. It's time for an annual question. This is from AJR, who's our AJ on Twitter, confusingly.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, after the Sunderland match, Wenger hinted at a possible 4-4-2. How soon do you see that happening, if at all?
I don't really see it happening, to be honest. I think it might be something that he could do during games if we need to, like stick two up top if we're chasing a game or looking for a winner or something like that. But I don't really think that we're going to see the starting formation change. So, I mean, that is what's going to provide him with the challenges of giving Giroud enough playing time, Alexis, you know, up front as well. So I think it might be something that he implements during a game, but I don't see it happening. I don't see it happening from the start, do you?
No. I think he pays quite regular lip service to the idea, and he talked about, well, I could play him as a wide or play him deeper, but fundamentally, and in fact, Thierry Henry was banging on about this in the Sky studio after the match, saying, I think Alexis and Giroud should play as a two together. But I think that's a very naive statement from Omri, because then where do you put Ozil? I think Ozil's position as the number 10 essentially dictates that you can only really have one other central striker if you want to have a stable midfield. So I don't think it'll happen. I think it might be something we do as an emergency, like you say, if we're chasing a game. But I can't see us. It's been 10 years, really, since we played 4-4-2 with any kind of regularity, and I don't see that changing anytime soon.
Mm, true, true. All right, here's one from bum, 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 Dewey, at Dewey the Gooner. And he says, why do you think Steve Bold never gets a mention when discussing Arsene Wenger's predecessor? Or successor, I guess, is the word he wants there.
Well, yeah, I guess he played under Arsene Wenger's predecessor. Good question, because, you know, apparently if you've been an assistant somewhere, you're definitely qualified to be the manager. If you ask Ryan Giggs, that's the way it works.
Mm.
But I suppose it's just purely down to lack of experience. But it's interesting, isn't it? If Steve Bold had been a higher profile player, like if Steve Bold, if it wasn't Steve Bold, but it was, say, Tony Adams or Patrick Vieira or Thierry Henry, a more glamorous name perhaps, it probably would be discussed, wouldn't it? It probably would be on the media agenda. But as it is, Bold doesn't get a look in. I wonder if his ambitions are in management. I imagine they are, but he must recognise that he'd probably have to go away from the club to fulfil those.
Mm. Yeah, you know what I think it is as well, though? I think we don't really know a lot about what Steve Bold wants.
No.
Or what his ambitions might be. You know, he's a pretty quiet character. Even when, remember when Arsene Wenger had a touchline ban? Was it 3 games in the Champions League a few seasons ago? And Steve Bold was the man. You know, he's not a demonstrative shouter and screamer on the bench, is he? He just seems to be there, sort of looming presence. And I'm sure on the training ground he's got a lot of input, and obviously himself and Arsene Wenger talk throughout the games. And I think part of it is that we just have no idea whether or not this is something that he wants. And I think from the little we have seen of him, it doesn't strike you that it would be something he'd be really comfortable with.
That's an interesting point. I think we're sort of sometimes guilty of the assumption that everyone who works on the coaching side of football wants to be a manager. There are lots of people who are very happy being a goalkeeping coach or coaching, I guess he's, as a coach, he's right at the top of his game. You know, he's working at one of the biggest clubs in the world alongside a great manager. He's probably very content with that. And he's worked his way up through the system, having coached the under-18s and reserves, so maybe he's just happy there. I don't think he's very media shy, and I guess what to your point, if he did have designs on a managerial career, perhaps he would be making more splashes in the media in an attempt to raise his profile. He doesn't look like someone desperate to put his head above the parapet, ironically, for such a tall man.
Mm.
So, yeah, I don't think he is an option. Do you consider him an option for Arsene Wenger's eventual successor?
I don't know. I just don't know. Possibly, if Arsene want to keep it in-house. But again, we just don't have enough information to have any real idea whether or not it's something he wants to do or is capable of doing. So I guess if you're in the game, though, and if you're working, like your ambition would probably be to be a manager. If you've been an assistant manager, a coach, you've done all the coaching badges, maybe he wants to be the manager. But I really have no idea. So I don't know. It's a good question, though. Something to think about.
Yeah, and I do think there is something in that idea that if he was maybe higher profile. He's 53 now, Steve Bold, so he's been coaching for some time. I personally don't see him taking over as Arsenal manager, but the next few years, you know, that perception might shift. Another question?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, why not? This comes from Ben H, who's at Neon Away Shirts on Twitter. And he says, when he eventually scores for us, how do you think Coquelin will celebrate?
He will celebrate by seeing the ball hit the back of the net. He will be so shocked and surprised at this that he won't be able to react in any other way than applying a manly handshake to a number of his teammates who will be congratulating him, and he say, chaps, steady on now. Still a game to be won here. Let's not get carried away with ourselves. None of this shouting and screaming like I do when all of you guys score. Let's get on with it. Like, I mean, I think that's the only way to celebrate a goal. Good slap nice, on the back. Nice. Well done, chap. Yeah. Well done. Now let's get on with it.
It's a very demure reaction.
Yeah.
There is a great photo of him. I mean, there's a great photo of him every week, but at Sunderland as ever, you know, flying into the fray, celebrating.
Yeah.
I don't know if he needs a goal. He seems to take so much pleasure from other people's.
Yeah. There was a moment, wasn't there, where he was clean through. He was almost clean through.
Yes. Yeah.
And
yeah.
I was thinking, holy shit, is this the moment? Is this the moment? And then he turned back into the way of the defender and got tackled on the edge of the box. A bit of a shame. Like, I'd love to see him score because I think he probably would just lose his fucking reason, to be honest. Depending, of course, when he scored, it would probably be like the consolation goal in the 90th minute when we're 3-0 down in some game, and that will be his goal, and he'll have to just go, oh, fuck, can't celebrate that, but, you know, we'll see. Circumstances will dictate. Chances are, if it was a big goal in a big game or an important goal, I think he would go crazy. Crazy.
Oh, can you imagine? I think he'd be in the crowd, definitely.
Yeah.
Whatever his celebration it was, I guarantee he would acquire probably his second booking for it.
Probably. You know, one of those where sometimes you see a player and they grab a player and they shake him, you know, and there's like a bit of, it's almost verging on too violent. It's like,
yeah,
please stop. You're scaring me now. Please stop. So we'll see. We'll see. All right. Here's one from Marshall Doig and he wants to know, worst Arsenal nightmare you've ever had? With a little asterisk. And it says, while sleeping, watching Mikhail Silvestre does not count.
I quite often have nightmares about North London derbies.
Mm.
They're the ones that really get to me. I had a dream. I remember once a dream, very specific dream, about losing 4-1 to Spurs at White Hart Lane. And I think Danny Rose may have scored all the goals. So that's definitely up there. Do you have one that you remember?
I did this thing a while ago, because whenever I have a weird Arsenal dream, I tend to put it on the blog.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So I did. I collated a few of them. So there's one from January 2015. It says, I dreamt last night that Stan Kroenke sold the Emirates to fund the new stadium in L.A., and the team were forced to train in Finsbury Park, where they would routinely get into fights with an American football team made up of barmen and other ne'er-do-wells who wanted to use the same space. Our home games took place in a tiny schoolyard, and the crowd was all around the walls. It was like Mad Max, because the opponents were being strangled by vociferous gooners until the league said we weren't allowed to play there anymore, so we disbanded the football club and became an import-export business, selling useless microchips to Scandinavia. So here's one from April 2014. It says, last night I dreamt that I was a sub for the FA Cup final, which was being played on a mud bath of a pitch at the far end of a school playground. There seems to be a common theme in my dreams here, tiny schoolyard pitches. In the end, I didn't get on, but Nicholas Bentner did, before he was immediately sent off for stabbing one of his own players because they deleted an Instagram selfie they took together just before the match. I said, I don't know how it ended up, but I'm taking some comfort from the fact that I was at least dreaming about the FA Cup final, and I'm guessing that wasn't too far before the semi-final against Wigan in 2014. So,
wow.
So there you go.
And Nicholas Bentner, who once, of course, headbutted Emmanuel Adebayor on the field, escalating things there by stabbing a teammate.
Yeah. Or here's one for Halloween from February 2013. Last night I dreamt that Arsenal's manager was an evil clown in full makeup who had a cutlass for a hand, and none of the people in the press conference would ask him any questions for fear that he'd behead them. This enraged him even more than being asked a question he didn't like, so he went on a frenzy, chopping and slicing and all kinds of stuff. The story never even made the papers. This was considered acceptable behaviour. So there you go.
Oh, God.
My mind is very strange.
Chilling. Happy Halloween, guys.
Yes, happy Halloween to you. And okay, we've got one more, given that it is Halloween. This is the final question of the day. It comes from Rebel Alliance at Coffee and Cave on Twitter. And he says, which team would be the best? Vampires, ghosts, werewolves, zombies, or killer clowns?
Ooh. Right, well, ghosts, I mean, can ghosts kick the ball?
I don't even know.
You'd need poltergeists, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, but again, we have this thing where they wouldn't be able to see each other, so... Unless ghosts can see each other, I don't know.
They can in the film Ghost.
Hmm.
Do you remember? He meets the guy on the tube, and what have you.
Oh, yeah, I think
he teaches him to push stuff. Well, that's Ghosts. We come back to them. Werewolves, I mean, night games, they'd be good, but during the day...
Pretty much,
aren't they only werewolves at night?
Yeah, but they're only werewolves when the full moon is out, so...
Right, so they're just a team of blokes.
Team of blokes, yeah. And vampires as well. I mean, fantastic.
They're going to struggle with...
Yeah, they're going to struggle with the 3 p.m. kickoffs.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know how they feel about floodlights. I'm not clear on that one. Dressing room and no mirrors for them. So that leaves us with...
Zombies or killer clans.
I mean, it's hard to look past the killer clans. We know who's managing them as well. It's the guy from your dream.
Yeah,
the cutlass hand man.
Yeah, that guy.
Yeah. And he's got experience at Arsenal. Do you know what I mean? So there's obviously good strategic mind at the helm. I think zombies aren't going to be much cop. I mean, there have been times with this Arsenal squad, it's felt a bit like zombies with the injuries we've had. But let's say Ghosts, I think, could be good if they were very well attuned. You know, if they can see each other... then it's all fine, but I'm going to go... But then killer clowns can't kill a ghost.
But they will be playing Spurs. The problem is...
I see, right, yeah.
Eventually, you would run out of killer clowns because they'd be killing people, right? And that is sort of against the law. And
it's
illegal.
A red card offence.
Yeah, and ultimately there would be a measure of corporate responsibility that would have to come into play because the FA would say, Look, we know you're playing Tottenham, and we know your team is killer clowns, but, like, could you keep the beheading to a minimum? This is a, you know, we were trying to get this product out there across the world. It's a bit gruesome, it's a bit gory, and Tottenham have got a game next week as well. They've got no players left now. And you completely destroyed Sunderland the week before. You know, so many deaths. Come on, stop.
I mean, for obvious reasons, I would like to watch the Killer Clowns play Spurs, but I suspect the better team in the long run would be the Ghost team because, let's not forget, I mean, it's a slightly morbid thought, but all the great players of the past can effectively sign for the Ghost team at a certain point in their life. Because, you know, when you're a ghost, you're you at your prime, aren't you?
Are you, though?
So,
I
don't know. I'll be honest. I'm not an expert.
You'd like to think that was the case. Like, you know, the idea of, you know, an afterlife and all that kind of stuff. We're getting into some heavy shit here. But the idea you know, that you go to heaven, for example, and what? You're at your peak as an 18-year-old or a 25-year-old? Or are you not just up in heaven as the 87-year-old withered old man that died of, like, I don't know, gooch cancer? You know... Is that
not how you're
in heaven?
My favourite idea is that you get to choose. That's, you know, that would be good, wouldn't it? You could what age would you choose, given the chance?
Probably like mid to late 20s.
I think. Really?
Yeah, no, or maybe now. I don't know.
That's a good answer.
Yeah. I quite like now. Although I'd like to be younger and know that... You know all the stuff that I know now, but be slightly younger. But yeah, I don't know. Okay. This is a bit morbid now.
Yeah, you can tell it's the end of the podcast. Basically, I think the Ghost 11 will win.
Okay.
I'm sorry to say, old Cutlass Clown. I think they're promising, but as you say, you can't get away with that for long. Sooner or later, you're going to come a cropper.
Ghost. All right. Well, we're playing Ludogorets tomorrow night. We're also playing Tottenham on Sunday. We've got a North London derby. We'll look ahead to that on the Arsecast on Friday. So until then, have a great one. Have a very, very happy, scary, spooky Halloween, and we'll catch you next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.